Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
This is the Interpreter Foundation radio show, sponsored by LDSAgents.com. The Interpreter Foundation exists to encourage study of the gospel and faithfulness to the church by making the latest scholarship available in its journal, publishing books, holding seminars, creating documentary films, and by providing roundtable discussions of the scriptures. You can find us at interpreterfoundation.org, where you can find all of our materials, including these radio programs that are posted as podcasts. You can also subscribe to this show in iTunes or through any of the other podcast apps on Apple and Android devices. If you like the show, tell your friends about us, write a review on iTunes or on your favorite site for podcast apps. My name is Steve Densley, and tonight we are talking about the book of Job in our Come Follow Me roundtable discussion. Mark Johnson is with me in the studio, and Spencer Krause is also with me, and Professor Matthew Bowen is joining us by phone from Brigham Young University, Hawaii. Aloha, Professor Bowen.
Aloha, Steve, Mark, Spencer.
Aloha.
Mark, why don't we start out by acknowledging the generosity of our sponsor, LDS Agents.
I'd be happy to. Our sponsor is LDSAgents.com. It's a network of over 3,000 real estate agents serving Latter-day Saints across the United States and Canada for more than 20 years. They've been helping Latter-day Saints like you find homes in safe neighborhoods with the right schools, including schools for special needs, and a temple not far away. Everyone at LDSAgents.com speaks your language. So why not let LDSAgents.com reduce the stress of buying or selling a home? Go to their website and take a look around at all they can do for you. LDSAgents.com. One more time, that's LDSAgents.com.
So tonight in our Come Follow Me discussion, we're going to be addressing, most of the book of Job. The chapters that are listed in the Come Follow Me discussion are chapters 1 through 3, 13 through 14, 21 through 24, 38 through 40, and chapter 42. We'll probably touch on some of the chapters in between. You know, I think that people ought to read the whole book. You know, Victor Hugo, about the book of Job, said the book of Job is perhaps the greatest masterpiece of the human mind. And he said, tomorrow, if all literature was to be destroyed and it was left to me to retain one work only, I should save Job. Tennyson said it's the greatest poem, whether of ancient or modern literature. Daniel Webster said the book of Job, taken as a mere work of literary genius, is one of the most wonderful productions of any age or any language. And Thomas Carlyle said there is nothing written, I think, in the Bible or out of it of equal merit. So, Professor Bowen, can you tell us about where the book of Job fits in the biblical canon?
We have the threefold division of the Hebrew Bible. It's often referred to by the acronym Tanakh, which stands for Torah, the T, the Nevi'im, the prophets, and the Ketubim, the writings. The Torah, of course, is the five books of Moses. The Nevi'im is the everything from Joshua and the other historical books, 2 Samuel, 2 Kings, and the prophetic books. And then you have the writings, which include Psalms, Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, and so the book of Job it falls within that last category of the threefold division. It's a part of the writings, the Ketubim.
So this is sort of recognized in the Hebrew Bible as basically a book of poetry. Is that fair to say?
Clearly the five books of Moses carried more weight for, in ancient Judaism. And even now in many ways, and then the prophets, and then, the writings, seem to have, even carry a little bit lighter weight in terms of, their authority.
You know, there are different genres in the scriptures. You know, and by that I mean we may have one book of scripture that is historical. Another book, you know, might be, you know, telling us a story or reciting a poem or giving us lists of, you know, good ideas on how to conduct ourselves. Mm-hmm. Mark, can you tell us about genre literature within the Hebrew Bible?
Well, it's important that we know about that because I think we can often bring our own expectations and our own, you know, cultural reading habits to, you know, these ancient texts, which might not have, you know, conformed to the same expectations that we have. It's easy for us to start reading the scriptures and it being a honest to goodness, you know, word for word, day by day account of, you know, of what we call history. But if we're aware of, just different kinds of genres, you know, we might not, you know, be able to, we might not fall into that same kind of trap, but we can appreciate the text for what it is. As an example, if I was to tell you, a story about my friend James, who came from Ireland, you know, you might think, oh, this is history. But if I started off by saying, let me tell you of, Jimmy O'Rourke, who hails from a town north of Cork, you might think, oh, this actually isn't history. This is a limerick. You know, this is an entirely different thing than history. Jimmy still might exist. He might be a real person, but that's not the point of the genre. You know, it's to tell a different kind of story or to, you know, make a funny point. It's the same with the different genres of the Bible. There's a lot of overlap with other, you know, other cultures, you know, in antiquity, as well as the Book of Mormon. You know, you've got different genres, like, you know, these books of wisdom literature, which talk about, you know, ways to thrive in the land and to please God and to, you know, acquire honor for yourself.
So in the New Testament, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, maybe a good example of this would be that Jesus often spoke in parables.
He did.
So we might hear a recitation of a story of a good Samaritan, mm-hmm. you know, who's traveling between Jerusalem and Jericho, and there are certain facts that are related to us, and then there's sort of a point, you know, to mm-hmm. to this story. Now, I suppose there might have been a good Samaritan. This might have actually related true history.
Oh, it might have, yeah.
But the purpose of relating it was not so much to relate the history of the story as it was to prove some other point.
Right, to talk about, you know, in this case, Christ was asking, you know, asking his audience who their neighbor was. You know, and in the point of this parable, or, you know, in the parable, you know, the existence or reality of this good Samaritan is kind of secondary. That's, I think, what we find throughout a lot of biblical literature. The authors are giving us the stories of Adam and Eve and Abraham and Moses and David, but, you know, they can't give us necessarily the actual Abraham or Adam. You know, we've got, you know, quoted words here and there, but to give us the stories and to give us the stories that the authors and the narrators want to tell us, they have to create and shape the stories. You know, you have to leave out certain details. You know, we find this in the Synoptic Gospels. You know, quite frequently, the authors of the Gospels will, you know, some of them will leave out, you know, different stories. Other times, you know, we find Christ performing miracles out of order based, you know, as they're presented in a different gospel or teaching a sermon, you know, in a different place than what happened in the earlier gospel. And each of the, of these biblical authors, is doing that, shaping their accounts to deliver, the maximum impact for their listeners and their readers. So things that are in these biblical texts are, you know, likely based on, you know, most of the time real people. It might not always be the case, but that's not the point that the author was trying to make. In the book of Job, for instance, you know, the author was not trying to prove to us that, you know, Job existed and that he lived at a certain time and from a certain place. You know, that wasn't his focus, his intent of writing that. He was, you know, putting all these and compiling all these, you know, bits of wisdom and advice together to answer, you know, in this case, a specific question about, you know, mortal suffering and how, you know, how does God relate to that, that suffering?
Well, much of the book of Job is told through poetry, and this appears in the writings, you know, along with wisdom literature, such as Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Sometimes it comes across sounding very much like Proverbs or Ecclesiastes or Psalms. But Professor Bowen, are there examples in, you know, the law and in the prophets where poetry is used to describe actual events?
Yeah, the poetry is found throughout the entirety of the Hebrew Bible in different ways in different places. For example, you know, it just in "Come Follow Me," with which a lot of church members are familiar with. Yeah, you got that phrase, "Saul hath killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands," that's phrased as a poetic couplet, and you'll have it just dropped there in the narrative as a, you know, as a, an important part of what the author is trying to say. And you find it in, you know, snatches of poetry or nuggets of poetry throughout the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses. And of course, you know, when Nephi talks about the manner of the prophesying of the Jews, I think he has a reference to in no small part to the way in which we find prophecy recorded in ancient Israel, and it's laid down in poetic verse largely. And so, you know, just recognizing poetry where it occurs, even in translation, is important to understanding how scripture is trying to convey its various messages.
All right, so the fact that something is related to us as poetry maybe gives us a clue as to how we should interpret the message, or, you know, what message we should be looking for, but doesn't necessarily help us know whether the events are historical or not. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it has no, it's similar to, you know, you see things that are sometimes ideological. Whether something's being told in an ideological way has no, you know, in and of itself, it has no bearing on whether it's historical or not. And that's sort of the same thing with, you know, poetry in a lot of contexts. It's and again, getting back to what Mark was saying about genre, we have to be careful that we don't get so caught up in, you know, the ancillary issues that we miss the main point of what a text is attempting to convey. And the reason the book of Job is considered what some have called the crown jewel of biblical literature is because of its message and the dialogue and the theological themes that are being worked with. And if we miss those, we're missing the point of the book.
Right. What do we know about the author of Job? You know, the book itself doesn't tell us who the author is. Do we know anything aside from that?
We don't know a lot, and it could have multiple authors. And one of the way that, for example, Elihu's speeches intrude into the text may be an indication of, you know, of that multiple authorship, with that speech being perhaps secondary to the original book.
Well, and then the fact that we'll talk a little bit about this in a few moments, but this structure shifts back and forth. So we have what has been called a frame to the whole book that is in prose and kind of outlines the the general setting and the characters that are involved in the story. And then it launches into this extended poetry that you know makes up most of the book, and then reverts back into prose, you know, to kind of complete the framing. Some people have proposed that maybe this indicates that there are multiple authors, that you have the frame maybe, you know, is one author, the poetry maybe is another, and then, as you say, you know, Elihu kind of takes a different approach than the other, you know, friends of Job, and maybe this signals another author.
And there have been some people who say that, like the prologue and the epilogue, as Steve mentioned, were written by one author, and they would describe that as they've called that as the author of they called it Job the Patient, and then they called the poetry sections is written by Job the Impatient.
Well, and I've seen all sorts of theories about who may have offered this. Some people think maybe Moses, maybe somebody named Job authored it, or, you know, Elihu.
Maybe Shakespeare. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Well, Solomon, Isaiah, Hezekiah, Baruch, Jeremiah's scribes. The biblical commentators, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, said, "All that can be said with certainty is the author was a loyal Hebrew who was not strictly bound by the popular creed that assumed suffering was always the direct result of sin." The other thing that's interesting is that there are other stories like this that, you know, are floating around, many that predate Job. It may be that... like the flood stories, or like Tower of Babel stories. It may be that this was a story that was kind of generally known, and other cultures recorded it.
There's other analogs of those, like the flood story you mentioned with Gilgamesh, and
so they've found similar stories among the Akkadians, Babylonians, Hittites. And so there's debate about when it was written. Was mm-hmm. this written, during the time of Moses? Was it written during the time of Solomon, or during the Babylonian exile? We don't know a lot about any of these issues. The setting itself seems to be sometime maybe during the patriarch era, Adam or Abraham, mm-hmm. Isaac, Jacob. It doesn't seem to be set post Mosaic code,
right? Because a lot of the things in the Mosaic code aren't really pertinent to the story. The reverence for the Torah and all the many numerous sacrifices are quite
the way
absent.
In which sacrifices are carried out.
Plus,
the age ascribed to Job as well at the end suggests that perhaps it's conceived of as occurring earlier.
Yeah, he does have ages in common with a lot of the earlier patriarchs. Plus, he's also described as someone having, like Abraham, the same blessing of many camels and sheep and, she asses and all these things. So,
yeah, and now it's been argued that the opening and closing of the book are very similar to other historical works of the Bible. And so maybe that gives us a hint that the author is intending to signal to us that this is historical. Paul quotes from it. Ezekiel chapter 14, verse 14, Job is mentioned along with Noah and Daniel, which suggests maybe Ezekiel saw him as a historical figure. James.
Yeah, in fact, I would say that's important because it suggests that, like Noah, that Job is an established figure by the time of Ezekiel, that he's well known.
Well, and that the listeners, whoever's reading Job or hearing Job, whoever's reading it or hearing Ezekiel recited, it's expected that they would recognize that Job, is a historical figure of the kind of like Noah or Daniel. James, the Lord's brother, refers to Job as an example of perseverance in James chapter 5, verse 11. One of the arguments for the historicity of Job as a person Keith Masurvey gave a devotional address a number of years ago, and that's been relied upon by others. The argument he made was that in the Doctrine and Covenants, when Joseph Smith is in Liberty Jail suffering, that that the Lord tells Joseph Smith, "Thou art not yet as Job." You know, and so the suggestion is that you know, that God wouldn't have said that to Joseph Smith if Job didn't really exist. I'm not convinced by that argument. I think that what we read in the Doctrine and Covenants, you know, where it says, "Thou art not yet as Job," that could easily be another way of saying things could be worse. You know, the whole book of Job could be, you know, a poetic kind of parable, and we could be saying, "Look, it's not that bad." So I'm not convinced by that argument, but there are other arguments, such as, you know, what Professor Bowen just said, that Ezekiel refers to Job along with other historical figures. You know, James is referring to him as a good example. Those kinds of things I find, you know, maybe more persuasive. You know, it's interesting too to think about the way that we have interpreted the book. Daniel Ludlow said that interpretations of the book of Job have been so varied and extreme that it's often been claimed that Job has suffered more from the hands of critics than he ever did from the hands of Satan. You know, there are different ways. You know, people have interpreted quite broadly, really, over the years. More recently, I think that the interpretation has been that this is, you know, basically an allegory or a parable. And, you know, what does it say about, the nature of our existence in this world? And, you know, those interpretations have been different. One of the things that, you know, in the common understanding of the story is that this is about a guy who's very patient. And, you know, we talk about the patience of Job. So that phrase, patience of Job, comes from James chapter 5, verse 11. It uses the word, and I may not be pronouncing this correctly, but Professor Bowen, you can tell us what this means, hypomenen, or hypomenia.
Yeah.
What does that word mean?
It literally means to, like, continue under.
Okay, so when we say the patience
then
of Job,
mene means to abide or continue or to remain. So kind of the idea of remaining under certain circumstances. The more evocative word is the Latin word that's used to translate that, and that's where we get the idea of suffering, patire, the idea of suffering, long suffering.
Well, most modern Bible translations will translate this word as endurance. You know, so it might be better to say the endurance of Job rather than the patience of Job. Where patience, you know, it's like I'm patient because I'm able to accept delays or problems without being annoyed or anxious. As we get into the text, Job does become annoyed. He does become anxious. Mm-hmm. You know, it wouldn't really be a good description of how he's relating to these trials he's experiencing. He's not simply, you know, sitting on his hands and, you know, waiting it out. I'd go so far as to say he's complaining to God about, you know, why is this happening? It's not unlike what Joseph Smith is doing in Liberty Jail, you know, where Joseph Smith is saying, "How long shall thy hand be stayed, and thine eye, yea, thy pure eye, behold from eternal heavens the wrongs of thy people and thy servants, and thine ear be penetrated with their cries? Why aren't you listening? Don't you see this?" You know, and I think that's very much like Job's reaction.
I agree, and I think he's got a good point, honestly. You know, it's where's justice? You know, if God is a just God, where is this justice? You know, and I think he's fair in answering that. Are asking that, and we, you know, find a, you know, answer a little later in the book.
Well, and, you know, in Job chapter 21, verse 4, the King James Version says, where Job is saying, why should not my spirit be troubled? It's almost alone in translating it this way. Nearly every other translation reads, why should I not be impatient? You know, and so the text itself kind of undercuts that idea that, you know, Job is the quintessential example of patience. So let's dive into the text here.
Steve?
Oh, yeah.
Can I make just a quick comment?
Yep.
And this relates to our topic of the last hour. It's interesting to me that in Matthew 10:22, when Jesus uses the phrase, he that endureth to the end, this is one of the phrases that came up in Neville's work. But it's that the word for endure there in Matthew 10:22 is that same word. Hypomeno. It's in the form hypomenas. But it's that same term, and so that connects us with the idea of enduring to the end, in a broad sense, but also in the doctrine of Christ sense. The idea that, which connects a lot with themes of Job and, you know, the path, and the way to wisdom.
Okay. Spencer, do you have anything to add to that?
I think Matt summed it up quite well.
Okay. Well, then as we get into the text, we are introduced to this man from the land of Uz. Okay, now that's another thing that people will use to say that this is, kind of like, you know, saying once upon a time or, it's from the land of Oz or something, which is interesting because when the Wizard of Oz was translated into Hebrew, the translator of the film's subtitle chose to use the land of Uz instead of the land of Oz. There's, I guess, a sense that maybe this is, you know, sort of a fantastical place.
Oh, and if I could maybe have Matt, maybe just kind of build on this idea. Matt, what is the meaning of the name Job?
The meaning of the name Job?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what the name means. People have transposed letters within it. You know, Job is you switch a couple of letters around and you end up with Oyev, which means enemy, and so you have this Midrashic idea that, you know, Job is being treated like an enemy of God, which, you know, sort of bears out in some of his complaints in the book.
You know, in terms of whether Uz is a real place or not, one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the War Scroll, refers to the land of Uz as existing beyond the Euphrates. Uz is sometimes identified with the Kingdom of Edom. That's roughly in the area of southwest Jordan or southern Israel. So there are some references to this as being a real place, even though, you know, if I go to buy a plane ticket, I can't find a ticket to Uz. But it does sound like there are some reasons to think that this was a real place that existed historically. Job is called a perfect man, upright, who feared God. He's got a lot of stuff. He's got seven sons and three daughters, lots of sheep and camels and oxen and asses. And, you know, it says that his household is greatest in all the East. And then there is this, this is another reason why people, maybe suggest that Job's not historical, is that there's this, divine council, that takes place, where the sons of God, Joseph Smith changes that to children of God, that they come to present themselves before the Lord along with the Satan. Now, in my view, this all fits very well with Latter-day Saint doctrine, that there are such things as councils in heaven with sons and daughters of God coming together in council, and that... you know, that Satan would be among them in terms of being one who we read about Satan appearing in a council in Abraham chapter 3. So the fact that you have this kind of event doesn't, to Latter-day Saints, suggest that this should be read as an allegory or some kind of fable. This fits very well with things that we understand actually happened. But then we also have this word, the Satan. So people suggest that this is you know, some kind of a you know, mythical figure, that it's not what we would understand as Lucifer or the devil, that this is simply, you know, a person who has appeared on the scene among the sons of God, who is an adversary. So modern translations often translate, you know, Satan as the adversary, which doesn't seem to me to be a problem for Latter-day Saints either. We often refer to Satan as the adversary. Mm-hmm. What do you have to add to that, Professor Bowen?
Yeah, I was just going to say you'd appreciate this in particular, since you come from a law background and are a lawyer by profession. The term HaSatan means either the adversary or the accuser, like a kind of in the sense of a prosecuting attorney in a way. And then the setting with, you know, God and the children of God, or God and the sons of God, the divine council is a court setting.
Right. So this would be sort of like the plaintiff. You know, the plaintiff comes along to, you know, to accuse. You know, he's the one that's bringing the case against Job.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, all of that, I mean, it's very consistent with what we would understand to be actual events. These are the kinds of things that we understand actually happen, you know, in on the other side of the veil. So the fact that we're calling him the Satan or the accuser or the adversary doesn't mean this isn't actually Lucifer, and that Lucifer is not actually saying to God, you know, I am going to go and, you know, test Job, and he tells our Heavenly Father, you know, the only reason Job follows you is that, you know, he's had it easy, and, you know, you've been protecting him, and so, you know, if you let me take all this stuff away, then Job is going to curse you. And so God allows Job to be tested in these various ways so that he loses his family, he loses his possessions. And then, you know, eventually he also is stricken severely with physical maladies. You know, and so how is it, Mark, that Job responds to this?
He takes it all in stride. I was just going to add really quickly that all of this seems to be very kind of against, you know, what we would call a prosperity gospel nowadays. You know, where God will bless you if you give, you know, your money to the guy on TV, the preacher guy there. Job responds to all of this by saying, well, you know, I came into this world naked, and that's guess how I'm going to leave. So, you know, he takes it all in stride.
Yeah, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. You know, so in this, what, you know, it's called the frame, the, mm-hmm. you know, this prose section, some people have suggested that this is, you know, maybe satirical even, that, you know, this is kind of, you know, making fun of how somebody might react to having, you know, their complete, you know, their life totally obliterated. I'm not sure I agree with that reading. I think it's possible to read all of these different elements of the story together, mm-hmm. and that maybe we see a little bit of a, you know, a shift in Job's approach, so that he's, you know, initially, I guess, somewhat stoic about it. Mm-hmm. And then over time, he becomes really frustrated, but he never loses his faith.
No.
he never loses his confidence in God. He never loses his faith that God is there, and that God, you know, has power to affect this situation. He's just really frustrated that God's not using it to fix everything for him.
Yeah, and I think that that's just kind of typical of the ancient mind. They wouldn't necessarily doubt the existence of God. They would just maybe doubt if they were loyal to the right one.
Well, in chapter 2, when it talks about his physical maladies, it talks about, you know, boils from head to toe. Some people suggest this may be elephantitis. You know, his face was so deformed his friends didn't know him. He had boils so bad that he would have to scrape them with pottery. Maggots were breeding in the sores of his body. You know, he smelled so bad that he went out to sit on the dump heap, you know, at the outside of town. Had terrifying nightmares. His wife, you know, in some sense seems to kind of, you know, give up hope and tell him to curse God and die. Job says, "Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God and not also receive evil?" And, you know, and later he says, "For I know that my Redeemer liveth, that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh I shall see God." And we see that as Latter-day Saints as evidence that very early there was an understanding that we would be resurrected and that there would be a Redeemer. You know, there are others that try to discount this. I'm not convinced by that. To me, this seems like that this is some pretty good evidence that there was an understanding that there would be a Redeemer, you know, someone who would pay the price for us and that we would be resurrected.
And Steve, that's an important point when we were talking about the legal language of, you know, at the outset of the book of Job and the idea of a legal setting. The term that he uses there in Job 19 is goeli. You know, the someone's goel was the nearest kin. Sometimes a better translation of that phrase would be
not redeemer now, right?
Be not redeemer, but kinsman redeemer. It's a member of your family who's responsible to stand up for you in a legal setting and uphold your rights. If you've been sold off into slavery, to buy you back out of slavery, to buy back family property that's been sold off and so forth. And so, you know, with so you have the idea, Job's idea that he has a goel in heaven to match the figure of the accuser, to counteract the charges of the accuser in that heavenly court.
Right, and so, you know, some people say that he's just talking about, you know, any old guy that's going to come and, you know, redeem him. But it doesn't seem to me that the text requires that, and that it makes
sense to talk about
a redeemer as Christ.
In any case, a goel was never just any old person, and in the divine sense, you know, that's one of the most important points of the book of Isaiah is that Yahweh is the goel of Israel. He's Israel's kinsman redeemer.
Okay, that's a great point. Thanks. Then Job has these, you know, they're called friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, that come and they sit with him for 7 days just speechless. I suppose that could be interpreted as, they're doing the best they can because they just don't know what to do, and they're sitting with him. Which in some time, you know, in some cases that may be all we can do, And Job at this point now he wishes to die.
They should have sat and listened.
Right.
The problem is, and I think this is one of the reasons the dialogue with the three friends is even in there, as we're. these three friends are modeling how we should not approach people who are suffering and struggling. You know, later, Elihu makes the point about Job's limited perspective, which Job later acknowledges that he's speaking from a limited perspective. But also the three friends are completely monochromatic in the way that they think. You know, their whole approach is you must have done something. There's no way you would be suffering unless you'd done something. It's like Mark said earlier, you know, this is one of these, you know, it operates on the same thinking as the prosperity gospel. The idea that, you know, if you're prospering, you must be doing it right, or on, you know, the opposite. If you're suffering, it's necessarily because you have been sinning. And I think that's one of the main points that the book is making, is that we should not approach people who are suffering the way that these three friends do.
Yeah, in logic, this is called the fallacy of affirming the consequent. So the way that works is that the fact that something, well, if we could explain this in terms of, you know, if A then B is true, then B then A is true as well. And that's the fallacy. So, for example, if it's true to say that sinners will suffer, you know, eventually at least, that, you know, his friends are saying that it's also true then that people who are suffering must be sinners. But it's a logical fallacy. It doesn't follow to say that just because, you know, we suffer when we do things that are wrong, that doesn't mean that if we are suffering, we must have done something wrong. And this book, in some sense, is an extended illustration of that. That, you know, we've got Job, who's, you know, he's described as being perfect, and, you know, repeatedly is saying, I didn't do anything wrong, and, you know, why am I going through this? And his friends, so-called friends, are saying, well, obviously you did something wrong, otherwise you wouldn't be suffering. And like you say, Professor Bowen, this book is very forcefully and repeatedly and loudly proclaiming that that's false doctrine.
I like all this. There's a little excerpt I want to read out of the Encyclopedia Judaica on the book of Job. It talks about one essay that talks about how the book of Job is a handbook on pastoral care, and it says, to be more precise, the book of Job is not about the vocation of rabbis or other clergy that includes visiting the sick and the bereaved. In fact, most of the book of Job deals with the question of how not to behave when attempting to carry out these obligations of you know, what we'd call ministry, you know, with respect to the sick and the bereaved among us. You know, it's clear that, you know, perhaps the three friends of Job did their best work during that first week.
So Joseph Smith said that it is an unhallowed principle to say that such and such have transgressed because they have been preyed upon by disease or death. For all flesh is subject to death, and the Savior has said, judge not, lest ye be judged. And Joseph Smith also said that those who accuse place themselves in the seat of Satan. That's so interesting, considering that Satan means the accuser.
And that's what the word devil means too. Diabolos means a slanderer, someone who, you know, launches an attack on or an accusation at somebody.
Yeah, and I think it's also pertinent with that quote from Joseph Smith in Kirtland after the Kirtland Safety Society failed and Joseph Smith got really sick. A lot of the apostates were saying, oh, this must be happening because Joseph is a fallen prophet now. And it's falling into that same kind of pattern where, you know, they're assuming that because Joseph is suffering that he must have sinned, which I think could also give a lot of context to that as well.
Yeah, so, you know, when we talk about how it is we should approach those who are suffering, you know, I like what Alma says at the Waters of Mormon, you know, those who are willing to mourn with those who mourn, you know, come forward and be baptized. You know, sometimes that's all we can do when people are mourning. You know, Job's friends want to lecture him. You know, I think in some sense they want to fix the problem. You know, they want to say, look, if you would just straighten up and fly right, then, you know, then this wouldn't be an issue. And, you know, again, we just don't know that that's why somebody has encountered problems. You know, and very often it is the case that, you know, somebody's done something wrong, and that they're suffering for it, but it doesn't really help, you know, to say this is your own fault. You brought this on yourself. If we want to lift them up and help them to recover, maybe from self-inflicted wounds, we're probably more well advised to mourn with them for the things that they are experiencing and show them love and compassion, rather than offer a lecture or a sermon. Now, Job, the book of Job, I think also addresses these issues of, you know, whether it's necessary for us to really understand everything. You know, Job is trying to understand, and his friends seem to have it all figured out, and they're telling him, well, this is really what's going on. Eventually what happens then is God appears on the scene, and he chastises Job for questioning him. You know, it's like, you know, Job, you know, I was listening to you. I did hear you. You know, you have no idea how this all works. You know, you weren't there when I, you know, created the world. And, you know, you don't understand. I'm the one that sees the end from the beginning. You know, Harold B. Lee commented on this. He says, it's not the function of religion to answer all questions about God's moral government of the universe, but to give courage through faith to go on in the face of questions he never finds the answer to in his present status. Therefore, take heed of yourselves. And as a wise world thinker once said, if the time comes when you feel you can no longer hold to your faith, then hold to it anyway. You cannot go into tomorrow's uncertainty and dangers without faith. I think that's one of the main main messages of Job, is that we don't need to understand why this is happening to us. We don't need to have the answers. We need to have faith. You know, we need to, you know, demonstrate our loyalty to God. We've made covenants. You know, and that's what faith, in some sense, means is trust. You know, that, you know, though he slay me, I will trust in him. President David O. McKay said that the purpose of the book of Job was to emphasize the fact that the testimony of the Spirit, the testimony of the gospel, is beyond the power of Satan's temptations or any physical influence. So that if we have trust in God, that, you know, that will help us to endure. And, you know, maybe we ought to be coining the phrase the endurance of Job rather than the patience of Job. But I really like what John S. Tanner said. John Tanner was, he was the president of your university.
Yes, he was.
Matt, and he was also, what was he, the first counselor in the, it was in the Sunday school presidency?
Yeah, he was in the Sunday school presidency for a while, too.
Right. So he said the book of Job is at bottom about the need for revelation. Revelation is the key to human crises of faith brought on by suffering. This interpretation fits our theology, which stresses the need for both general and personal revelation. That the Lord responds at all assures us that he is not just a Deus abscondus, as Job fears, but a God who condescends to reveal himself to us in our darkest hours of need. Mark, you have in front of you a book of presentations that were given at a Temple on Mount Zion conference.
I do, yeah.
Where one of the presenters looked at Job in a temple context. Can you tell us about that?
I can. It's from the Second Interpreter Foundation conference on the temple. It is called Job, an LDS Reading. It was written by Max Sterling, and he talks about how, as you go through the narrative of the book of Job, how it resembles a lot of the contents and overall form of our modern temple endowment, how it starts off by living in idyllic circumstances. Then Job has a fall from grace. He's outside in the lone and dreary world. He's living in ashes, and he's put to a lot of tests to test his loyalty to God, to test his commitments. And then finally, at the end, he is God again returns to him, and he's brought back into God's presence, and receives a fullness of blessings.
I think that's great. It's called Temple Insights. It's published by the Interpreter Foundation. It's volume 2 in the Proceedings of the Interpreters, Matthew B. Brown Memorial Conference, Temple of Mount Zion.
And you can find the book on the Interpreter Foundation website if you'd like to order a copy for
yourself. And the article's there too, because it was published separately in the journal as well.
Oh, that's right. It was.
You know, in wrapping this up, I think that Michael Austin, in his book on Job, I thought made an insightful comment where he said that, as countless readers have pointed out, the book of Job does not answer the question, why do bad things happen? It does, however, tell us that humanity's most common answer to this question is wrong. Material misfortunes, the poet insists, do not trace back to moral choices in any way that human beings can evaluate. There are profound consequences to knowing this. It means that paying tithing won't always make our finances work out, and that going to the temple won't ensure that our children go on missions. It tells us that some people will do everything that they are supposed to do and still experience profound tragedies, while others will flout all the laws of God and die rich, old, and in bed. It means that the universe does not belong to the category of things we can predict or control. You know, and then following up on that, I like what John Tanner says about that, that, you know, we need revelation, and that in the end, you know, like Mark was describing it, you know, Job passes back through the veil into the presence of God, and, you know, he doesn't necessarily get answers to his questions, doesn't necessarily know why it is this was happening, but he does know that God lives and that his Redeemer lives. In this way, we can be inspired by Job's endurance. Yes, Professor Bowen.
Yeah, if I could just make one quote or make one comment before we sign off on this. It's interesting that, you know, Job does, he's brought back into the presence of God, but it's, you know, he's been sanctified by what he's experienced. He's been changed by it. He doesn't go back into the presence of God the same way he was. And that helps us see the connection with the plan of salvation. And I also like how at the end, when God restores to Job twofold, it's interesting to me that he doesn't get the double number of the children that he had before. And as you know, several biblical commentators have noted previously, that suggests that the idea that Job's original children that perished aren't totally lost to him, so that he doesn't need to receive twofold more of children in the restoration, but that and anyone who's lost a child will know that, you know, you don't just replace the child by having another one, but the idea seems to be present there that, you know, that first set of children aren't fully or irrevocably lost to Job.
That they will be with him beyond the veil, and that he will have even more children than he had before. I think that's a great insight. Thanks for joining us on the Interpreter Foundation's Come Follow Me Roundtable Discussion of Job. This is KTalk Radio, and join us next week.